It is September 9th, 2016. This is Jen Brown, and I'm here with Duffy Ramirez to talk about his experiences in the Chicano movement. Do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we start by, can you tell me about your childhood and where you grew up?
I grew up in San Diego, Texas. It's not too far from Corpus. And I went through school all the way through high school, graduated in 64. My family moved to Alice after I graduated. So I was the only one in my family. I was the oldest one, and I was the only one that graduated from San Diego. But I always had real strong contact with, I still have family there and so on. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated in 64, I went to Texas A&I, okay, which is in Kingsville. But growing up in San Diego was, to me, it was a very good experience. I mean, it's a small community. I'd say by 99% Mexican American. So I really didn't have too much of an idea of the conflict that there was between, let's say, Anglos, Mexican Americans, as they were in other communities where I met students that came from other communities where, you know, you had a distinct division, mm-hmm, whether it was physical or geographic or you know, some kind. But there was, you know, those things did exist, but I wasn't aware of it until I left the community and went to college.
Okay. What was your family like?
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. What was, how many family members did you have?
Oh, we were six of us. Like my brother here, I have, there were four boys and two girls, my mom and dad. My dad was a World War II veteran. My grandfather was a World War I veteran. So we've been in the community for generations. On my mother's side of the family, same thing. Their family came from through Mexico, but back in the 1800s. San Diego's an old community. Over the years where I met people, a lot of them had connections to San Diego in some way. It's one of the oldest communities in the area. And in the valley, there are probably two communities that are comparable in age. That would be like Brownsville and maybe in Rio Grande City. But so there's a lot of history there as far as the family goes. And on my dad's side, it was more difficult to trace back the genealogy on my father's side of the family. My mother's side, I've had some cousins that have traced it back all the way to Spain and stuff. So.
Okay. What were the schools like?
I'm sorry, what?
What were the schools like in San Diego?
The what?
The schools.
I'm sorry. You know, I have a little difficulty with my hearing sometimes. It's hard to pick out exactly what you're saying. Okay. The what?
The schools.
Oh, the schools. I'm sorry. Yeah okay. The schools were good. I mean, I felt like I got a good high school education. In fact, when I went to college, I used to talk to other people from other schools, and I could see a difference. I thought it was pretty good. Also, we were in San Diego. They made an effort to teach us some of our cultural heritage. I remember having a Spanish teacher in the sixth grade. She was, from Mexico. And she exposed us to a lot of things that you would probably be exposed to if you lived in Mexico. I mean, whether it was the foods, candies that she would bring, you know. She would make, we had to recite these long poems in Spanish, and were called declamaciones or something like that. They were long. I don't remember too much about it, but I remember that was her focus. The focus of that class was basically to teach us about our culture. And she also put on a program every year in which we were participated in some of the traditional Mexican dances that you see in programs today, you know. So I had some of that, which I'm pretty sure a lot of schools didn't. But I guess the school district made an effort to provide that for us. But we still weren't allowed to speak Spanish outside of in school. You know, there's even though it was a 99% Mexican American community, they still had that rule. You know, no speaking Spanish. So there was that. You know, that's something that you find in a lot of schools in South Texas, but surprisingly, and even in our own school. But it was pretty much a bilingual community. I mean, almost everybody, I think, had dual language abilities. Even though the Spanish that I grew up with was not your proper, you know, Spanish language. You know, a lot of what we call Tex-Mex today or Spanglish, you know, it's sometimes you just literally translate things. Other times you just make the English word into a Spanish word by adding a few letters to it.
Why did they forbid speaking Spanish in schools?
I think possibly because they wanted this to concentrate on English, since everything is going to be done in English pretty much. The schooling, the curriculum and everything is English, you know. So, and possibly also they're maybe unconsciously trying to Americanize all the students, you know, make sure that, you know, they learn the language of the country, you might say, you know, even though we don't have a national language as such, but I think that was probably the focus there. But it kind of like imbued a negative stereotype, you know, that like speaking Spanish was bad, you know, or something like that, you know, so that probably doesn't play well with the psyche of people, you know. I know I had difficulties when I went to college with English, you know, regular coursework, you know, English. I was in for a shock when I went to college, basically. Even though it's only 38 miles from San Diego, it was very different for me. And, you know, and I noticed that right away.
How were those experiences different?
How was the college?
Yeah.
Well, when I went to A&I at that time, I entered it in 1964, was I think possibly the ratio was 20%. I mean, there were about 20% Mexican-American students, so we were in a minority. There were divisions. You could see it. All you have to do is look back at some of the yearbooks. I have three of the ones that the 4 years I was there, and you could see, for example, in fraternities and sororities, they were totally white. You wouldn't find any Hispanic students, Mexican-American students in those fraternities. I remember there was one guy he was Hispanic, but he was from Argentina, and he worked with the King Ranch. So, you know, but you take a regular Mexican-American student from South Texas, not in there. There were dances every Thursday night. They had a dance called the Dateless, usually with a live band, and you could see there too. You know, the Mexican American students would be in one side of the ballroom, and the Anglo students would be in the other side, and there was no crossing over. And it wasn't something that, I mean, it wasn't overt. I mean, it was just the way it was. Sitting in the cafeteria once in a while. I mean, again, the Mexican-American students sat in a certain section, you know, whether it was by choice or not. Once in a while, there were people that did, of course, move around. But there were those kind of differences, you know. And in class, I remember the first class that I took two classes the summer that I entered school, one an English class and a history class. History was great, my favorite subject. I did well. But I was in English with the head of the department. I was the only Mexican-American in that class, and I was totally intimidated. I was out of my element completely. And then the professor didn't help. He was kind of aloof. He dressed like a Southern plantation owner, you know, with a hat and the white shoes and stuff, you know. I was like, okay, just, it didn't register with me. Anyway, so... but, you know, one thing about going to college was that I lived there in Kingsville, even though a lot of people that lived close by were commuters. I didn't. I wanted to live there while going to college. I wanted that experience. And I did get that experience. I got to meet students from South Texas that also were too far away to commute. So I got to know them. We got to kind of bonded together. There's a lot of people that came out of the movement from A&I. Jose Angel Gutierrez was there 2 years of the 4 years that I was there. I think he was a junior when I entered as a freshman, but I got to know him. And not only that, his roommates. So there were people from the Winter Garden area, people from Del Rio, people from Laredo, people from Brownsville and parts of the valley. And since we were there on the weekends, we got a chance to talk and to get to know each other. And in some cases, particularly the guys from the Winter Garden area, begin to kind of impact my thinking as far as, you know, there's something, we need to do something, you know, because they had grown up in a divided communities, you know, and something which I hadn't, but I could see what was going on at A&I, and they began to talk to me, and eventually, you know, I started to come around to their way of thinking, you know, that the changes needed to be made and so on, and everybody was in that mindset. A lot of things were happening in 64 in those years around the country. The movements had begun. In 62, the farm workers had started their picketing and protest and all that. You had the free speech movement in California in 64. The war was escalating. At that point, it started to escalate. And not too long after that, they started drafting people. So those were things, you know, and of course the civil rights movement was, you know, even though you didn't have as much of that in A&I or the Valley because you didn't have that concentration of black people, but you still had some. And so that, you know, but we were conscious of what was going on with the Freedom Riders and all this stuff going on in the South. So all those things had an impact on your mindset, you know, that you want to be part of it. And of course we were young also, and it was exciting. I mean, you know, and so we got involved in school issues in some elections. I remember we campaigned for a guy right here from Corpus, Ronald Bridges. He was running for a state senator or something, and some of the people that I was hanging around with, you know, they were actively working on his campaign, you know. Obviously, he was a good guy or something, you know. There were issues. There was an underground newspaper at A&I. For a while there, a kind of a newsletter that was called a rag with an E in parentheses after that. And that, I remember one time going with one of my friends to the professor's house to pick up copies of it. So I figured out, well, that must be where they're running them off, you know. It was a sociology professor of mine, Dr. Bittinger, and we would go and put them in different parts of the campus to distribute, you know. Nobody knew who made this or what, you know, but I got an inkling that, you know, was obviously some of the teachers were involved and some students were writing articles for it, you know. Usually with issues of the university. I remember another issue that happened there when I was still in school there was a dorm mother who was pressuring this young lady, she was Anglo, who was dating a Mexican-American from Rio Grande City. And she told people about it, you know, that she didn't like the way she was. It was that dorm, you know, she was kind of telling her, look, it's going to be bad for you, you know, you shouldn't go out with this guy because, you know, whatever reason she was laying on her, but she didn't appreciate that. And there was actually a little march towards the dorm people. I don't remember how or how it got organized, but I remember we marched and had some signs and stuff, and I think the lady got removed. The dorm mother got removed from that position. I don't know. But it made me see that change could come about sometimes through confrontation, through just simply going out and demonstrating that you didn't like what they were doing. So those things had an impact on me, you know. I got involved with Mayo. Mayo, by the time I was a senior, junior, senior, Mayo had, Jose Angel had gone to San Antonio, was going to St. Mary's, and Mayo got started. I remember I had a picture. I remember I used to have a picture with a Mayo button on my cap. So I said, I know it was during college. I remember we drove, I had this friend of mine named Carlos Guerra, who's passed away, but he's from Robstown, and he was another one that was very involved in the movement. He's seen some of the pictures that I gave the man here. And we drove to Laredo. I remember we drove to Laredo. There was a meeting in a theater. And I'm assuming it was a Mayo meeting. I couldn't remember exactly, but there was discussion, and it was decided at that meeting that we're going to target Exxon for the discriminatory hiring practices. I think it was called Exxon back then still. I mean, I know it changed its name, but it was the Exxon company. And that was basically the decision that came out of that meeting. I remember we came back to Kingsville, and by the weekend, we were picketing. There was an Exxon building in Kingsville, close to downtown. And we went and picketed on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday during the day, you know, walked around with signs claiming that, you know, they were discriminating in their hiring practices and so on. The building wasn't even, I don't even think that was open that day, but we just wanted to make a point because that's what the decision had come to in that meeting in Laredo. In fact, it's been bugging me that I wanted to ask Jose Angel whether, was that a Mayo meeting? I don't know. I assume it was because there were people there from all over. It wasn't a massive meeting, but still there were people there that I didn't know, and this discussion was done and action was taken.
So how did the students get connected to other students? Was it just personal connections elsewhere? Compared Kingsville to say San Antonio or Laredo.
But at ANA, you mean?
Yeah.
Could you repeat that again?
Just how did you connect to students elsewhere?
Oh, well, like I said, it was a small community. I mean, we didn't hang out. We hung out with each other. We partied, you know. We'd meet at parties or in class, you know. If we took classes together, because at ANA at that time didn't have the big population that it might have now. I don't know what the student enrollment is, but it was still a small community within, and then smaller for us because we were less of us. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got to know each other, usually through social contact. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Samora, who's also going to be one of the presenters, he was at school with me during that time also.
His roommate's coming today, by the way.
Hmm?
His roommate, who lives here in town now,
really?
Is coming.
Oh, okay.
Just as a heads up. But how did the other Anglo students treat this small group of people involved in the movement?
Well, I don't know if they were even aware of what we were doing. I mean, in terms of being in the movement, there were some Anglos and Black students that were also involved in some of the campus type issues. I remember there were a couple from here from Corpus, Mary Jo Sanders and her brother Mac. They were Black students. They went to school there. Marva Sams, who's still here in Corpus, she was involved. We had Bill Ritchie, Pat Lawrence. This, you know, they were some liberal Anglos that sympathized and we all were thinking along the same lines of changes. I remember this was campus stuff, but it hadn't grown into the statewide movement that it became later on, but this was the beginnings of it. So it was just, you know, wherever they were from. I remember, you know, I had friends from Brownsville, like I said, the Windgarden area and all these areas, and sometimes we visited each other and just, you know, we were friends in some ways. You know.
What sort of campus issues did you start with?
A campus?
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, most of us didn't live in the dorms. You know, we all had either boarding houses or little apartments where we usually three or four guys lived together and stuff. And same thing with the girls. In fact, we knew where all the girls lived, and they, you know. And so we hung out together. I remember Dr. Samora was, he lived in a house. We called it a haunted house. It was old, and I remember the floor sagged. You know, you walked in and made this creaking sounds, and it sagged. And there were, you know, we used to have, there were parties there because it was a big place. And it was close to campus. I remember he used to cut my hair. He on the side would cut guys' hair for, you know, to make some extra money and stuff. And so if there was something going on, people knew about it, especially on the weekends, you know. So this is how we all kind of became bonded in a way, you know. And then a lot of us ended up getting involved in the movement once we left college. And so we'd see each other in different places. I mean, when I went to the Valley, you know, there were people who were had been at A&I that I hadn't met at A&I, but yet I got to know them over there. And then others who I knew at A&I who were also working in different areas of the movement, mm-hmm. whether it was political activists or artists. We had quite a few artists, too, that did movement stuff, that a lot of their work was movement-oriented during that time. And so, you know, it was it was exciting. You know, I enjoyed it.
How did everyone start getting involved in the larger movement?
In the larger movement?
Yeah. I mean, well, what was your involvement in Mayo?
Okay. Well, like I said, like that meeting and all this, but the thing is that this was happening toward the end of my college days there. So when I graduated in 68, I went to the Valley. I got me and this friend of mine named Tony Bill both got a teaching job in Brownsville. There was a guy walking around campus with contracts. At that time, there was a teacher shortage, and they were even hiring people with as little as 60 hours to teach. But, I mean, here we were graduating, and Tony and I said, well, what do we do, you know? Well, I hear there's this guy, he's hiring teachers in Brownsville. So we talked to the guy. We ended up signing up, and we ended up at the same school in Brownsville, an elementary school, not what I wanted, but still, it was a job, and it kind of kept you out of the draft, I think, at the time. I don't remember that we got a deferment for that, but I remember Tony was sweating it out because he was from Kerrville. By the way, his name is Tony Bill, but his real name, well, his full name is Antonio Pruneda Bill. He said Chicano, just that, you know, he's got the last name Bill. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and I lost my train of thought. We both got a job teaching in Brownsville. And for example, Emilio, he stayed, I don't know, he didn't graduate in 68. I guess he graduated after me. I know that he was involved, for example, with another student friend, Victor Nelson, who's also a Mexicano, in helping one of the professors, Dr. Albro, develop a Mexican-American studies problems class, because his area of expertise was Mexican history, not Mexican-American history. So he really didn't know, and these students, I found out later on, had helped him develop a course, you know. So that was, for example, that was their involvement. And then later, I know, well, Emilio went on to higher education. Me and Tony were teaching in Brownsville, and nothing much was happening as far as the movement was concerned with us. Now, in the Valley, this was in 68, 60, my first year there was 68, 69. There was a walkout in El Cauchelsa in 1968, but I really didn't go out and get involved in it. The following year, I got a job. I left Brownsville, and I got a job teaching in Westlaco. And that was in 69, the year, school year 69-70. Well, that December 69 was when they had that Mayo conference in at La Lomita Mission in Mission, Texas. I didn't go to the conference. I didn't even know about it until I read about it in the paper. Because I had kind of been out of touch with the movement people during this first year and a half that I had been teaching. So I knew there had been a conference. I didn't know what had happened at the conference. But teaching in Westlaco, some of the kids that were, I'm sure a lot of the kids from the Ed Cochells of Walkout had been at the conference. When I was teaching, some other kids from other school districts got fired up, who went to the conference also. Because I know that in Westlaco, there were two students that came back after the conference in the spring, which would be early 1970, and filed grievances with the school board there were only two. It wasn't like the big, large mass walkout. But these two students took it upon themselves to file some grievances. They were also filed with the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights and with DEA, which then investigated and found out that, yes, Westaco was discriminating against students, tracking them, for example, into vocational when instead of the academic part of the school curriculum.
Did you experience any problems teaching there as a Mexican-American?
No, see, I was teaching in junior high, and these were high school kids, so I didn't know exactly, you know. Junior high was different, but, you know, Westaco was very different. When I was teaching in Brownsville, I was allowed to grow a beard and stuff, and back then, so when I went to Westaco, I had to shave, and I had to wear a shirt and tie every day. I mean, you know, so they were kind of strict and very, you know, in that way. But personally, I didn't experience any of that, because in junior high it's pretty basic, you know. But I found out that there was a rally that was being held in support of the students. I found out about the students who had, you know, done this, and I said, I'm going to go check it out. So I went. This was like in April, before the school year ended. They had organized this rally for the students, in support of the students. So I went to listen to it, and after the rally finished, I approached some of the people that had spoken. One of them was a teacher from Donna, but he was from Westaco, but he taught in Donna, which is in the community next to Westaco. And I just said, you know, hey, I teach here in the school district. If there's anything I can do to help, I sympathize with what you're doing and all this, you know. And then they said, you know, we'd like to meet someone. But, you know, it's in Mission. This person is in Mission. In fact, he was living at the La Lomita Mission. The place where the conference had been held happened to be also the headquarters of a daycare center. And some people who had been at the conference had stayed on. In particular, this individual named Aurelio Montemayor, because at the conference, there was a lot of people they had this idea for starting up a college, a Chicano college. Okay? That's where the idea was born at that conference.
That became the colegio.
Yes, the colegio. That's what became the colegio. And so Aurelio was one of the persons, along with another guy named Narciso Aleman, who were kind of pushing this idea for Chicano college. And when I think about it now, you know, a lot of the kids from the Valley particularly had been part of the walkout, stuff like this, that they were also behind this idea. You know, they liked the idea of having a school where they, you know, could fulfill some of the grievances, for example, that they had. They weren't allowed in the regular schools, learning about the history of their own people and being able to speak Spanish and, you know, things like this, you know. So after that rally, we drove to Mission, and I got to meet Aurelio Montemayor. And this guy was very enthusiastic, you know, very gung-ho with the idea. By the time I met him, they had already made contact with Antioch. Antioch was the school that ended up being our accrediting college. So they had already had contact with Antioch, and he was now in the process of looking for other people to join the project. And the project was going to involve having graduate students who were going to be working on their master's. At that time, Antioch offered a master's of arts in teaching, an MAT. And so it excited me because, one, I get to work on my master's. I get to do something that's very unique and in some ways radical, because it was going to be, I mean, nobody had ever done this before. You know, you just start a college, and then you want the college to be a reflection of your culture and yourself, you know. It's like a Chicano college. So I said, yeah, you know, I'll go with you guys. And in fact, I went back to Westlake to school the next day. I mean, you know, this was on a Sunday, I remember. And on Monday, by the way, at the rally, there was a guy that stood. The assistant principal had also gone to the rally. He was this big, tall, white guy named Larry Cross. And I said, Larry, he asked me what I was doing there. He said, what are you doing here, you know? He said, oh, well, they sent me here to check it out, you know? So sure enough, first thing Monday morning, I get called into the principal's office, and he's saying, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing getting mixed up with these people? And then I told him, look, I said, I met this guy. This is what I'm going to do. I'm gonna get involved with this thing. And he said, oh, man, it's going to mess you up. And this was a Mexican-American principal that's talking to me. He ended up becoming the superintendent of Westlaco High School later on. I mean, a Westlaco School District later on. But he thought it was going to be bad for me, you know. He said, oh, you're going to ruin your career, whatever, you know. I said, well, I'm already committed. I said, I've made a commitment, and I'm going to do it. And I did, you know. And between April and May, and then part of the summer, we started helping out. We were driving to Austin and meeting with people over there that we were trying to see if they would work with us, you know. In fact, Juan and Marta Cotera, and Andre Guerrero from Laredo, but also was living in Austin. I remember meeting with them. We all met with them. We'd sit around and talk and discuss what we wanted to do. We were also, Varelio was also gathering information for position papers. We wanted to have some position papers by different people as to why we wanted to do this and how we were going to go about it if we could, you know. So they made a commitment too, and they became part of. In the end, we ended up with 14 students. There were graduate students all working on their masters. Some of them were recruited by other people, and then some came in at the last minute, but right up and by the last minute, I mean, school didn't start until October. So between, you know, the time that I met with them in April and up until then, we had been working towards that. There was a small firm in Washington, D.C. called Interstate Research Associates, led by an activist named Raul Izaguirre. Now, Raul Izaguirre is more known for being the head of the Southwest Council for La Raza for many years. He's the one that kind of helped to build up that organization to what it is today. But he was a guy from San Juan who was actively involved in the movement and the early stages of the movement, and he enabled the meeting between Antioch and Aurelio and Narciso. You know, but of course, this happened before I came along, but during the summer, he also helped us obtain a grant, a planning grant, to develop a Chicano Learning Center. I think that was what the grant was. It wasn't a lot of money, but it enabled us to, and he also housed us in, they had an office in Edinburgh also, so he let us use their office, and we hired a secretary, we got a typewriter, and we started putting out information, mostly to other Mexican Americans who wanted to be part of this effort. You know, so we were trying to recruit not only students, but faculty members, people who were willing to come down and teach weekend seminar or something, you know, because obviously these people had jobs. So the only time they could devote or contribute to us would be maybe on weekends. So we were trying to get people, you know, like that, you know, to come join our effort. You know?
How did you recruit them? I mean, what sort of language and
goals? How did we recruit them?
Yeah.
Well, we just appealed to their sense of La Raza, you know. I mean, you know, this is why we were doing this. You know, we wanted to change things. You know, we wanted to change the system, you know, or push the system to change. Just the fact that what we were doing was actually going to push the system anyway, because, you know, things began to change after that. But there was a lot of resistance in the Valley, for example. The Valley tends to be more conservative. People don't like big changes, you know, and so we were, you know, very different from what people would expect professional Mexican American students to be or something, you know. Even though a lot of us had degrees and so on, we were seen as radicals. We were seen as, you know, rabble rousers, whatever, you know. I mean, that we're creating more problems for them, for other Mexican Americans, than trying to help. I mean, that's the way some of them saw it, especially the professionals. They're worried about getting involved with this because they could tarnish their reputation. The kind of thing that my principal was telling me, you know, when I had made the decision to go with the colegio. But there were others that were, you know, especially more the intellectuals, the ones who were teaching at universities and so on, were more inclined to, and those that worked in areas outside of the valley. We didn't get a lot of support from the people at Pan American, for example. That was the university there in the valley. But we got a lot from A&I, University of Texas, Sam Houston State, University of Houston, places like that, where there was an occasional Mexican-American professor, a noted professor of some kind, and they believed in what we're doing, at least and they were willing to come and work with us. Américo Paredes, Tomás Rivera, people like that came down and helped us out. And they didn't need a lot of convincing. I don't think that, you know, I think they understood what we're trying to do and wanted to support us in some way and were willing to contribute their time.
Mm-hmm. How did that idea of a community-controlled, you know, nature of the Colegio impact the university, the college itself, and the work?
Well, that was the basis for the Colegio was for us to be accepted in our community. So we made an effort to go out into the community and talk to people and tell them, explain ourselves to them. We didn't want them to be freaked out with what we were doing. The white community was. They were, you know, they didn't know what we were doing and they were worried. In fact, in some cases, they started to attack us through advertisements and so on. But we didn't care about that so much, you know, because that's not who we were trying to please. We wanted to make sure that our own community accepted us. And I think they did. I mean, you know, some of the things we were involved in, for example, we got involved with grassroots organizations in the valley. One in particular was Colonias del Valle, which worked with unincorporated pockets of population in the county and trying to get them basic services like, you know, trash removal and water, things like this, you know, the streets, you know, paving streets or lights. This is the kind of things that people needed, you know, basic stuff. And so, you know, we work with organizations like that, the farm workers, same thing. Antonio Rendain, who was the organizer for the United Farm Workers in the Valley, he came and spoke to us about organizing and how, you know, how to do things, you know, to try to get a change in the fields, you know. And so that's how we approach the community in terms of the, you know, the people that lived in the barrios and so on. When we had an open house in February, because, like I said, school started in October. When Antioch was on a quarter system, so the semester actually started in October, and we had seminars, classes, and so on. But at the same time, we were planning on having some kind of celebration, an open house to kind of like let the community come in and see what we're doing, and we did. It was on February, I think it was February the 14th. I have the date somewhere when we had it. And right before that, I think on February 6th, there had been the FAR riots. So there was a lot of stuff going on in the valley during that time. The riot, you know, some of our people were involved in it in terms of like they were there when it started. We had been picketing the police department. I know I'm getting off track here, going into this riot thing, but this is all part of what was going on at that time. They had been picketing the police department, the claims of police brutality and things like this. You know, they FAR had a reputation for being heavy-handed with people, especially the cops, you know, and so there were allegations of police brutality and so on. The mayor used to have meetings when nobody could go, you know, community and stuff like that, you know. So Mayor Bo was the mayor at the time. So people were against that. And Maya was there. Maya was helping to organize. There was another guy, Efrain Fernandez, who also was from Kings Hill and had gone to A&I. Although I hadn't met him at Kings Hill, I got to know him in the Valley, working with Maya while I was working with the Colegio. And that day that happened, I happened to be, because one of the things that we also did was talk to civic organizations and community organizations, like we got a Lions Club. Juan and I would go to a Lions Club, or we'd go to a school board meeting in the school like in Mercedes where we were located. That day, I think I was at a meeting at Pan Am, meeting with teachers, educators who were interested in kind of what they wanted to know what we were doing. So I went to explain what we were doing as far as the Colegio. The organization was a short-lived organization called TEAM, that stood for Texans for the Educational Advancement of Mexican Americans. And on my way back, because that weekend we were also having a seminar, kind of a retreat at this place in Weslaco, when found out about the riot. Well, that blew the retreat, because everybody wanted to come back to FAR and see what was going on, all this. Of course, it was already over. But a man had been killed, and that wasn't good. And then there was a big march after that, that marched from the church in San Juan to FAR, to the cemetery in FAR, where the man had been buried. And I remember there was a flatbed truck that was used as a kind of a stage, and where people got to speak. And also, three priests had a mass right there on the truck, on the flatbed. And those are some of the pictures that I had. Efrain spoke, and you know, and that was that. But our open house was like a week later. We had scheduled it for a week later, and it was a big turnout. So I think the community was kind of accepting of us. I mean, the community that we were interested in. Mm-hmm. They were there in mass. We had food. We had entertainment. We had a teatro campesino. We had music. We had speakers. And I think it turned out well, you know. We had put up kind of a booklet together in Spanish explaining who we were and who the students were and how we worked and all this, and we're giving them out to people who came to the open house. So I think it worked out pretty good. My experience with the Colegio startup came to an end almost a year to the time that I had met Aurelio in around April. things began to get a little weird there at the Colegio.
What do you mean weird?
Clash of personalities, philosophical differences. There began to develop a split in the group.
What sort of philosophical differences?
I think it had to do with, some of it might have been having to do with people claiming that you weren't Chicano enough. You know, and this.
So they had recruited a bunch of guys that wanted to be superintendents and work through the Carnegie Foundation so they could get their certification, whatever is needed to be able to become a superintendent at some point in their career. And a lot of them were assigned to school districts, some of them in the Valley. We got a bunch of them at College Shelton, and they helped us do the new proposal for the next round, the way the proposals work, you know, every year you have to submit a new proposal. They helped us create one, and it was much larger. We got like double the funding and so on. So they were very helpful. And then again, that's, you know, the movement in Crystal City having an impact on what we're doing down here in the Valley. IDRA was another company that was working with our school district and helping our school district as we were going through this transition from, you know, Anglo to Mexican American, I guess, you know. That program, that the arts program in particular, we developed what they call an estudiantina. It's a musical group. It's cultural, guitars, singing, and all that, which eventually led into the mariachi programs. that you see in schools all over the place now. But back then, I think we were the first ones that did it. After a while, La Jolla, another school district that was very Mexican-American, hired the music teacher to develop the mariachi over here to their school. And, you know, and it began to spread, you know, and now, I mean, I can't think of schools that don't have a mariachi or some kind of a cultural arts program of some kind.
How do you think that, you know, you're talking about these changes with Mexican-American education. How has it changed? How did it change from the 60s to today or when you retired?
Well, yeah, all you have to do is look at people like Derek, like the guy who just wrote my, who wrote the new master's thesis on the colegio. There's young people like that that are working on their master's and doctoral programs that I've met personally. And you have people who have gotten into positions where they can then, in turn, recruit people like that. Example, I have a friend named Jesse Garcia. He called me yesterday. He was coming to the conference. I had told him about it. This was a, I knew him since he was like 20 years old. He was going to Pan Am. You know, he had been tracked into vocational. He went to a technical school first to be a diesel mechanic. He didn't like that. So he decided to go to Pan Am and did well. And in fact, he got his master's at Pan Am. And then he got recruited by Dr. Rogelio Sainz. Dr. Rogelio Sainz was a at that time at Pan American, I mean at Texas A&M in at College Station in the sociology department. And he was recruiting Mexican-American students to come and get their doctorate in sociology. My friend Jesse was one of the 70s, and they said, and they claimed that they were with the colegio, or they were colegio students. Well, it negatively impacted the colegio, you know. And so, oh, we knew it all along, you know, they're a bunch of radicals, they're a bunch of pot smokers, they're a bunch of gun runners, you know. Because there were instances in which people had been arrested in Mexico on allegations of trying to supply guns to the Marxist revolutionaries in Mexico. The student movements, you know, and all this, the Tlatelolco massacre in at Mexico City.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about how the movement was changing over time. What else did you witness of how the movement changed?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, that it's changed. I mean, the people haven't changed. It's just that titles and names have changed. You know, like I was talking about the Mexican-American Democrats. You have a lot of more people that are more aware of them. So I don't know if it's changed. I think it's just, I think the movement is still moving, you know. I think it's still very much an ongoing thing that people are, and you have more people involved in it, you know, in some aspect or another, you know. So I don't know. I see it in a positive view, you know, that the movement is still moving.
And you also mentioned that the perceptions of Chicano in the movement have changed over time. Can you expand on that?
Oh, well, when the word Chicano, I don't know exactly, but it started out during the time of in the 60s, you know, when people started using that term. For a long time, people had labeled us, you know. I mean, I remember growing up, and at one point we were Latin Americans. We were referred to as Latin Americans, Spanish-speaking Americans, Spanish Americans, Mexican Americans. You know, Chicano was not a word that anybody put on us. It was a word that came out of the people themselves. I mean, anybody can tell you that the word Chicano comes from the word Mexicano, which is a Nahuatl word. The X is pronounced like a CH, so you have the word Chicano, or from Mexicano, But I think it was more of the fact that people just wanted to identify themselves and not be identified by somebody else. You know, saying, and of course, even our own people didn't like that. You know, the older people, like our parents, you know. I think a lot of people got involved in the movement, like at A&I, the people that I knew, a lot of them were first-generation college students. You know, you were the first one in your family to ever gone to college. And when we started calling ourselves Chicanos, a lot of them, you know, they were like, what is that, you know? And they would come up with all kinds of explanations of what that word really meant, that it was something bad and all this stuff. And well, we didn't buy it. I mean, we just used it.
When did you realize and start calling yourself Chicano?
I'm back in college. I remember we referred to ourselves and we were Chicanos, you know, and Viva la Raza, you know, it's kind of, those are expressions that we used. I don't remember exactly, you know, it was just something that happened. I mean, I couldn't pinpoint the fact that when the first time I ever used the word Chicano to describe myself, but I know I've used it throughout my life as I became involved in the movement and in movement related things, you know. And people would still, you know, like, oh, you know, but I didn't care. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not a label that, like I said, that was put on us by somebody else. We came up with it ourselves. There was an organization back in the days also called Mecha. It was mainly out of California, I think. Just like Mayo, this was Mecha. But it was made out, I think, more of college students. And the Mecha, in Spanish, Mecha is a match, like a match that you strike. But it was basically an acronym. It's for Movimiento Estudiantil Chicanos de Aztlán. That's what the letters in Mecha stood for. That's the first time I think I ever saw the word Chicano in there. And maybe that's how it came about. I don't know. But I remember that Mecha was Movimiento Estudiantil Chicanos de Aztlán. And Aztlán, I don't know if you're familiar with Aztlán, but Aztlán was like the, represented the Southwest. So that might have been where the word got more popular use. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I know that, and there was no Mecha down here. I mean, as far as we knew, and I didn't have Mecha. There was no, but, you know, we were reading stuff and we were finding out about things, you know, and so somewhere along the way we started using that word.
Yeah.
And it became a standard, especially if you were the movement, you know. It kind of helped to identify you. Just like we had a handshake, you know.
What was the handshake?
Well, if you were a Raza guy, you know, and you were meeting another Raza guy, you know, then we'd shake like this, and we go like this, and then we go like this, or some, no, this is like this, like this, like this, and sometimes we do this, and then sometimes later on we added this. I don't know what, you know, but there was just a thing, you know. It's like, yeah. Okay, you're one of me, you know.
Yeah.
You do the handshake, you know.
Seems like there's a lot of fraternity in the movement itself.
Well, yeah, it was small. I think it was a small community. I mean, I could count on my hands, you know, like the number of people that I knew within the movement, whether they were from the Crystal City area, from Austin, whatever, you know, the Valley, you know. It's like, I don't know. We all knew each other. A lot of people knew, you know, or had worked together in some facet of the movement of some kind, you know. Even people from Colorado, you know, like that guy who helped start the Colegio Narciso was more affiliated with the Crusade for Justice in Colorado. That was headed by Corky Gonzalez. Now, Corky Gonzalez has his own place in Chicano history. He wrote a poem, an epic poem called I Am Joaquin. And I remember listening to that in a, back then, what they call a multimedia. It was a slide projector, and they would add music, and they'd flash the slides on the screen. And somebody's doing a dramatic reading of this poem. And I remember sitting there watching it, watching the pictures, listening to the thing with the sounds and all that. And it had a big impact on me. It got me all riled up. It got me like, hey, you know, it was something. And he was an interesting character too. You know, I read about him, you know, back in the days in the early 60s in college, the main three were, you know, Cesar Chavez, Corky Gonzalez from the Crusade for Justice, and later it was Jose Angel with the Mayo organization. Oh, and there was another guy, but the before Jose Angel, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, which was a land rights activist in New Mexico.
But except that they, you know, they got a little carried away and ended up killing somebody. I don't know what happened, and that kind of like, but those were the three main things of resistance that were going on in the early movement: the farm workers, the Crusade for Justice, and the land rights guy in New Mexico, Tijerina, and of course later on in Texas, you know, you have the Mayo springing up, you know, later on. But
what did you do in Mayo?
I'm sorry?
What did you do in Mayo?
In Mayo? Well, Mayo was, it wasn't like a card-carrying kind of organization, you know? If you were working in the movement, you were part of Mayo. It wasn't like, and I've read some of the stuff that Jose Angel has written about Mayo. The only ones that were like on a list, you might say, would be the hierarchy of Mayo. The people who were the board of directors or whatever, who was in charge of Mayo and who made decisions. There were chapters. I mean, there were like pockets of Mayo around. Sometimes there were high school kids and things like this. But there was no membership list or anything like that. If you were in the movement, you were part. You were doing Mayo's work. You know, I know when I was in college, I considered myself part of Mayo. But we didn't have meetings as such, you know. Like I remember going to that meeting in Laredo that I was telling you about earlier, where the decision to boycott and picket Exxon was made. I'm pretty sure that was a Mayo thing. But you had, you know, when I left college, I kind of lost track with Mayo. You know, they weren't sending out memos and saying, hey, we're having a convention or something like that. So I didn't know about that, you know, and I didn't really know the people in the Valley that I could contact with at that time until I ended up meeting the ones from the colegio when I was teaching in Weslaco. But there was no place that I could say, well, let me call a phone number of my own, you know.
Have you kept in contact with a lot of people in the movement?
Some, but not a lot, you know. I mean, I've met people along the way that are part of the movement now, you know, but now it's in a different level. But I haven't really, we had a reunion about in 2000, I think it was 2008, at A&I. And it was kind of a reunion of Chicano activists that have A&I. And a lot of the people that I was talking about, Jose Angel, Emilio, I was there, artists, Carlos Guerra, Cesar Martinez, Janie Alba. These were all people that were in school at the same time, and we're all involved in the movement in some aspect of the movement at different times. And so that reunion, and there was another guy who used to have a reunion also periodically from that group, you know, but he would have it over here at Port Aransas. But that was it. And after that, you know, I kind of like stayed out of it, you know. I kept on teaching, and periodically I would hear things and all that. But I kept on teaching in the public schools. And that bilingual directorship I did that for like 4 years. And then politics again got involved. This time Mexicans fighting against Mexicans, you know, school boards, and you know, one faction wanting to get rid of the other faction. And I left, and I said, you know, I wasn't from the community, so I said I'm quitting. I went back to teaching, which is what I like to do. And I ended up teaching for another 25 years. So all total in public education, I've taught 34 years.
And you were teaching history and?
History, and I got into computers for a while, but early stages of computer education, not technical at all, but mostly history.
Did you talk about Mexican American history in your classes?
Oh yeah. Whenever, in fact, I did teach a Mexican-American Studies class in La Jolla High School back in 1980. I don't know anybody was doing it, but the superintendent, I knew him from the past, and he said, you know, let's come up with a course. And they gave me the best students, and I used Rudy Acuña's book, Mexican-American Chronicles. It was, you know, pretty basic textbook, more of a kind of a loose kind of notebook, but I used that to give them basic stuff about our history. And I brought in speakers. Jose Angel came, spoke to my students, Amado Peña, Carmen Lomas Garza. These were artists. The guy Leo Montalvo also were guys that
that I brought into class to talk to my students. So I did, you know, that was, you know, but I only did that 1 year. And then the superintendent got ousted or he left or something, and then they didn't want to do that class anymore. And then I ended up leaving and going to another school district. But whenever I taught history, I always incorporated the culture and the history of our people into my lessons, you know, and try to, you know, give them something to that they could be proud of, or something that they didn't know about that wasn't in the books, because it wasn't in the books. So I had to design my own lessons for that. But that's.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention about your involvement in the movement, or anything that I missed?
I don't think so. I think I pretty much talked out.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Besides, I need to go to the hotel and stuff. So
okay.
Why don't we go ahead and end it up and.